This land is your land. This land is mine. From California to New York, from the redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello, everybody. This is Basma of the People Speak Radio. How are you this evening? Welcome to our show and welcome to the People Speak. Here, when the people speak, we make a difference. Tonight, we're speaking with Anthony Arnov, who is a literary editor, agent, and activist. He's also a freelance editor, writer, and activist based in Brooklyn on the board of directors of Haymarket Books. Is active in the National Writers Union and the International Socialist Organization. Mr. Arnov is particularly well known for his books on the Iraq War and the occupation of Iraq. Anthony is author of a new book called Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal, which toured the country in the spring of 2006 and as part of the New Presses and the War Tour. He's also the editor of Iraq Under Siege, co-editor with Howard Zinn, our favorite professor, and Voices of the People, History of the United States. He writes frequently for a lot of left-wing publications and is a featured author on ZNet. Welcome to our show, Anthony and Arnov. Thank you very much for being with us this evening.
Thanks for having me on.
It's our honor. President Bush, in your book, and I quote right here, said, President Bush boasted to an audience at Bowling Air Force, "We will never back down, never give in, and never accept anything less than complete victory." It looks like he meant it, didn't he, Anthony?
Well, unfortunately, it's not just he who means that, but most of his own party has the same belief, and most of the party that claims to be an opposition party, the Democrats, seem pretty committed to the same philosophy. So I fear that the problem is much bigger than George Bush. It's a kind of bipartisan assault, really, right now on the entire idea of democracy, not only democracy for the Iraqi people, who have made it very clear they want us to leave and they want to determine their own future, but also democracy here in this country, where a clear majority sent a signal in November in the elections, and also a clear majority in polls are indicating that they want the troops to come home. And instead, more money is being sent, more troops are being sent, and we're facing the prospect of a very long-term, open-ended occupation with more and more deaths and more destruction.
You know, we've just been made aware that Congress may actually be voting, close to drafting a bill to further fund the war with no timelines, at least until after September 30th. How will this affect or delay any chance or hope we have of withdrawal?
Well, if you go back to the Vietnam War, we see that the United States population was well ahead of Congress for years on the question of Vietnam. Only at the very end did Congress take any kind of action, and really at that point it was very ineffectual. And it was popular pressure, it was protests, it was demonstrations in this country and internationally, and particularly the protest of soldiers, of GIs themselves, that brought an end to that war. Congress was constantly lagging behind public opinion and the grassroots movement in taking any kind of action that would have restricted the president's war-making powers in Vietnam. And I think we're in a similar situation now, where Congress is continuing to fund the occupation. The new compromise, as it's being called, has no timetable for withdrawal of troops from Iraq. But even if you look at the bill that was sent to George Bush, the bill that the House and the Senate sent and was vetoed by President Bush, that bill had very vague language about withdrawal. It spoke about removing most combat troops by March 31st, 2008. But if you looked very carefully, it said troops could continue in Iraq for force protection, for counterinsurgency operations, and for national security exemptions. Well, of course, the whole justification that the president is giving to the troops being in Iraq is that Iraq is this mythical front in this global war on terror. And so, therefore, it was really a loophole that would allow for combat troops to remain in Iraq for years to come. Moreover, it said nothing about the private contractors, of whom there are 126,000 in Iraq, many of them mercenaries, who in effect are a whole other occupying force. Then it said nothing about the military bases that the United States has in Iraq. It said nothing about the fact that the United States has its largest embassy in the world in Baghdad. So really, it wasn't a withdrawal plan. And now they've backed down even on that very tepid opposition. So I think it's the leadership we need is not going to come from Congress. It's going to have to come from the grassroots. We're going to have to put pressure on both parties, Democrats and Republicans. We're going to have to make a lot more noise. And I think we're also, as the election cycle heats up, going to have to avoid a very dangerous pitfall, which is that there's going to be a lot of pressure on us to lower our expectations, lower our demands, and the hope that somehow whoever the candidate is of the Democrats, they're somehow, once they get in office, going to come up with a withdrawal plan. And I think that would be a very dangerous mistake for us to make. I think if we let up our own independent organization, our own independent demands, we'll be much less effective as a movement pushing for withdrawal.
Let me ask you, as you said, certainly our leadership in our Congress, I mean, we've had 31 votes this year alone about Iraq in Washington. Nothing has changed. Are we going to see more of Democrats doing no more than just talking? And if so, how does your logic of withdrawal fit in if you can't get any kind of government? Look, within your own book, Anthony, you wrote that the statements of Senator Lieberman and Hillary Clinton saying things like, we need more troops in Iraq now. This was Lieberman, the Connecticut Democrat, to the Hartford Current. Hillary Clinton noted as saying that absolutely voting and authorizing the president to wage war and standing behind the decision. That's the key. So what have we got here? We've got a government that is not responding to anybody, not the Democratic Party nor the Republican Party.
Yeah, because, you know, we're talking about spreading democracy in the Middle East, and what we're seeing is the lack of democracy in this country. But that's, you know, nothing new. We have a long history of using the rhetoric of spreading democracy abroad to actually cover for other aims that have to do with conquest of territory, markets, conquest of people, expansion of American imperial power, economic, political, military power. And that has always gone hand in hand with the suppression of civil liberties and suppression of democracy at home. So there's a long history to this dilemma that you're describing. But when I speak of the logic of withdrawal, I don't expect that the logic I'm talking about is going to be perceived by the Joseph Liebermans and the Hillary Clintons of this world, let alone the Dick Cheney and George Bushes. I'm talking about ordinary people coming to see the logic of withdrawal. I'm talking about the people who are being sent to fight to kill and be killed in Iraq, seeing the logic of withdrawal. I'm talking about the families of those people being sent to kill and be killed. And I think that's really where the power to end this war lies. It is with the soldiers themselves, it's with their families, it's with the communities they're coming from that are being torn apart by this war, and it's coming from the communities and those groups that are affected by this war that are going to have to put the kind of pressure on politicians, Democrats and Republicans, that will lead them to reach the same conclusion that they reached at the end of the Vietnam War, which is we are losing the war at home. And the consequences of staying are worse than the consequences of pulling out in terms of our ability to control the society at home, in terms of our ability eventually to be able to assert our power as an empire elsewhere. Because certainly the balance
sheet... So Anthony, you certainly believe that this is part of it, that this assertion of our power in as a greater nation than thou is not just a mythical imagining. Mythical in that a lot of people say that we are not imperialists. We have no interest in destabilizing or taking over nations. But in fact, that's exactly what we're doing. If you look
absolutely. It's what we're doing, and it's what we are determined to do, no matter how destructive it is to the people in whose name it's being done. So, in other words, you know, we hear this was a war to liberate Iraqis. Well, now 4 million Iraqis have been made refugees, 2 million within their own country, 2 million driven from their country. You have more than 650,000 excess deaths of Iraqis since the U.S. invasion, according to a study by The Lancet. You have a complete destruction of that country's infrastructure and social fabric. And the war was being fought in their name. And then the war was being fought in the name of the American public, being told this is going to make us safer, this is going to protect us. And instead, what it's only done is make the world far more dangerous, make us far more isolated. It's fueled the global nuclear arms race, which has greatly accelerated the risk of nuclear conflict or nuclear accidents, which at this point could literally destroy the species in a few moments. And the calculation of empire, the calculation of the desire to assert our power and control other people, is leading to a situation that I think Noam Chomsky very accurately described as leading us to a point where we have to choose between hegemony, the imperial project, or survival of the human species and of all the other species on the planet.
You know, one of the things that I've always wondered about, Anthony, and maybe you've got a take on this, how did Americans fall for this downplay that, as far as the resistance that we're seeing in Iraq? I mean, this was an all-out invasion, yet we were convinced as Americans that they were just going to welcome us and throw roses at our feet and love us. And here now everybody's shocked that there's this resistance, this insurgency, why did we fall? How could we have possibly have thought upon attacking with shock and awe that they would love us for that?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, first of all, if you look at how quickly public opinion turned against the occupation of Iraq, I think it's quite remarkable that despite all of the propaganda efforts from the establishment press, despite the positions of the mainstream politicians, including the party that claims to be an opposition party, the Democrats, given the lack of meaningful, articulate anti-war opinion in this country, which was systematically excluded from the airwaves, from television, from print media, in the run-up to the war, and certainly in the immediate aftermath of the invasion.
Absolute media
blackout. It's remarkable that people have come to the conclusion, on their own, more or less independently, that this was a complete mistake, and that it was wrong, mm-hmm. and that we should bring the troops home. That's without necessarily having heard or encountered any articulate, intelligent presentation of an anti-war case. So I think that the public opinion polls showing support for the invasion of Iraq were very thin and were based on a deliberate campaign of manipulation of public opinion, which was quite elaborate and took months of bombardment, not just by politicians.
Why did they want Iraq?
Oh, well, why, first of all, has to do nothing with the reasons that they told us. It had nothing to do with democracy or human rights. It had to do with the fact that, first of all, Iraq is the world's second largest or third world largest reserve for oil, depending on how you do your calculations. Iran may be in second place, may be just behind Iraq. But at any rate, it is one of the world's most strategic sources for energy. It sits in a region with two-thirds of world oil reserves and in a region with most of the world's natural gas reserves as well. It's the major shipping route for all of those energy resources. And in saying that, in saying it's about oil, it's important to add a couple of clarifying points, because the United States actually is not that reliant on energy from the Middle East. We only import about 14% of our oil from that part of the world. In fact, last year we got more oil from Africa than we did from the Middle East. But the United States understands that other countries, countries like China, countries like India, countries in the European Union, particularly some of the faster-growing countries in the world, are growing far more reliant on those energy resources, importing in some cases 70, 80, 90% of their energy from the Middle East, projected to double their energy imports over the next 20, 30, 40 years. And so the United States understands that if we control the lever of oil exports, if we control the natural gas of that region, we have a tremendous advantage over competing powers that could emerge as rivals to the United States' status as the world's sole superpower. And the U.S. is very openly committed to maintaining the enormous edge it has economically and militarily in particular over any what are called potential peer competitors to the United States, in particular countries like India, China, that are growing rapidly and that in the year 2030, 2040 could be major rivals to the United States status as the world's sole superpower. So they saw an opportunity after the attacks of 9/11 to go on the offensive, but to portray that offensive agenda, that agenda of dominating the Middle East, of engineering regime change, of establishing military bases in Iraq, of projecting their power, and potentially engineering regime change in other countries like Iran and Syria and elsewhere. They could portray that offensive agenda as a defensive agenda, as a response to a threat, as a response to terrorist attacks, as a response to imminent terrorist attacks that might come from Iraq. So they thought that it would be an easy way of having a demonstration effect, a way of intimidating other countries, a way of demonstrating American imperial power, and as a way of locking in those advantages that they thought that they would secure by going into Iraq.
You know, one of the things that I have to, you know, and this is so important, and I really want to get to it, and can you, in a downsized version, explain to us the possibilities or even the probabilities of your logic of withdrawal? How could, you know, I would love to be, I'm the first one that says, hey, let it happen. We need to be out. We absolutely need to be out. But let's face it, the logistics of a withdrawal are so almost insurmountable, Anthony. Can you talk to us about your vision of how a withdrawal would look?
Sure. Well, first of all, there's the reality of what a withdrawal will look like, and there's the question of what withdrawal should look like. The reality of withdrawal is that the United States is not going to plan for it. actresses, they didn't plan for it in Vietnam. They only have one plan, which is to dominate and subjugate. They have no way of taking in the political reality of defeat, which is what they're facing in Iraq. They can't understand the politics of their defeat. They see things only in technical terms, and they believe that somehow there's a technical solution to the situation in Iraq, and there is no technical solution. As long as the Iraqi people see the occupying troops as an unwanted foreign occupying power, not as liberators, there's no amount of plans for victory, there's no amount of counterinsurgency doctrine, there's no amount of troop surges, there's no amount of gesturing about Iran or Syria supplying the resistance, etc., that can lead to a reversal of that situation. So the likely form that withdrawal will take is going to be a very messy and complicated withdrawal of troops, in which they're going to try to keep hold of their base of power in the country through their influence over the puppet Iraqi government, through the U.S. embassy that they have in Baghdad, through the military bases that they're building around the country. But the reality is, if the Iraqi people have their way, they're not going to be able to hold on to any of those things. So that will lead to a protracted conflict. So I think what we have to be pushing for is a far more sensible withdrawal, which is a withdrawal based on acknowledgement of U.S. wrongdoing and error, that it was wrong to have invaded in the first place, that the United States has done tremendous harm to the Iraqi people and has a great debt of responsibility to them, that the United States will pay reparations for the harm it's caused, not just in this invasion and occupation, but before it, during all the years that it armed and supported the dictator Saddam Hussein, funded the Iran-Iraq War, imposed comprehensive sanctions for the 12 years leading up to the invasion in 2003, and did many other horrible things for which it should be held to account. It should be providing aid to the refugees, the 4 million refugees I mentioned earlier. It should be renouncing its military bases. It should be renouncing any influence through its control over the government, through advisors, and its influence over the government it put in place in Iraq. And it should also announce that it's going to support and fund genuine humanitarian and reconstruction efforts directed not by the United States, but by the Iraqi people themselves. In that situation, there's the possibility of a meaningful process of reconciliation and reconstruction in Iraq. In the absence of that, it's going to be a very bloody and complicated situation. And the longer the U.S. stays, the longer the echoes will be of the occupation, the more distorting the effects of the occupation will be on the future of Iraq.
Anthony, in the beginning of the war, or actually it was probably the months preceding the war, Rumsfeld over and over and over again said that it was not our intention to destabilize the Middle East. Yet a few days after Shaq and Ah, he said on a national television broadcast that we, when asked the same question, that we must destabilize the Middle East, which was a complete turnaround of his position prior to the Shaq and Ah attack. Has the Bush administration succeeded in destabilizing the Middle East, in your opinion?
Well,
and for those of
the defenders of the war would say that they've destabilized the Middle East. I think what's interesting is that there is an internal division within the U.S. ruling class and within military strategists, including a division among some neoconservatives, over this strategy of destabilization. There emerged, particularly within some neoconservative circles, the idea that you more or less had to throw up the pieces of the chessboard, let them fall where they may, and that U.S. power could reassemble the balance of interests and competing powers in the Middle East on terms more favorable to the United States than before the invasion of Iraq. They thought that they would be able to topple Iraq and that that would open up the route towards regime change in Iran, regime change in Syria, towards strengthening the position of Israel in the Middle East, and much strengthening the position of the United States. Instead, what they've found themselves in is in a situation where actually the United States is much weaker. Iran has emerged as a far more important and powerful player in the region than it ever could have imagined it would in so short a period. And the United States has further compounded the error and the strategic miscalculation of invading Iraq by backing the very bloody and destructive Israeli invasion of Lebanon last summer, which was a complete rout for Israel, and gave far greater legitimacy to Hezbollah, weakened Israel's position, weakened the U.S. position in the region even further, all again to the benefit of Iran. So now they find themselves, in a sense, hostage to fortune, which is why some people in the administration believe that the only way of kind of dealing with this situation is to double the bet and to contemplate very seriously the possibility of a military strike against Iran as a result. So you see how this logic of destabilization actually has led us into a far more dangerous situation.
And I have many thoughts on that. We do have a caller on the line, Mike from California. Will you please ask your question of Anthony Arnov? And for those of you that have just entered and joined us on Airwaves, we are speaking to the Iraq Logic of Withdrawal, Anthony Arnov. Mike, please ask your question.
Hello, Anthony. Thanks for coming on the show. Since the elections, you know, the campaigns are on now, I was wondering which of the presidential candidates seem to you to have the best plan for withdrawal out of Iraq? Thank you.
Well, I got to say, I'm not very happy with any of the withdrawal plans that I've heard from any of the candidates. And I'll tell you why, because if you look carefully at all of the withdrawal plans, they all have an exception that says not unconditional withdrawal, not immediate withdrawal, but not even total or complete withdrawal of troops from Iraq. So, for example, Barack Obama's plan says, just like this bill that was proposed and that Bush vetoed, that there are exceptions for troops that are engaged in counterinsurgency in Iraq, that are engaged in force protection, which is a bit of a catch-22, because if you're not there in the first place, you don't need to have troops engaged in force protection operations. Doesn't speak about the private contractors, the mercenaries in Iraq. So it's not actually a complete withdrawal plan. Hillary Clinton has said very openly that she will keep troops in Iraq. So really, of all of the candidates, the person who's come closest to a total withdrawal proposal is Denis Kucinich. But the problem is not that Denis Kucinich isn't a candidate worth supporting or doesn't have interesting proposals. The problem is that Denis Kucinich is a member of a party whose leadership is aggressively opposed to any fundamental and principled withdrawal proposal from Iraq. And we saw in the last election when Denis Kucinich was running and his delegates went to the Democratic Party convention, that the delegates who were elected by Kucinich supporters on the basis of opposing the war in Iraq were instructed to vote for Kerry as the party's presidential candidate, a pro-war candidate, and were instructed to vote for the pro-war slate, the actual language supporting the war in Iraq that was in the Democratic Party platform. So I'm very skeptical about that as a vehicle for withdrawal. I think it's going to take pressure on both parties, and it's going to take, I hope, more independent candidates running outside of the corporate duopoly of the Democrat and Republican, more or less bipartisan consensus on Iraq.
Thank you. We have with us Anthony Arnov, author of Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal. If you'd like to call and ask a question, our toll-free U.S. number is 877-270-8714, and our international number is 888-861-3519. Our next question is coming from Iraq. Our gentleman's caller's name is Aziz. Aziz, will you please come and ask your question of Mr. Arnov?
Thank you very much. My question to your lovely guest here, Anthony.
Aziz, can you speak up a little bit? We seem to have kind of a low connection.
That the Americans must help the Iraqi refugees. Well, don't you think that the Americans should do more than that, because they have imposed the regime of Saddam Hussein on the Iraqi people in 1963 when the CIA helped bring the Ba'athist regime to power and Saddam Hussein, and also when they supported Saddam Hussein to kill more than a million Iraqi in the Iran-Iraq war, and later on in the Kuwaiti invasion they came back and kicked him out of there. Finally, when they used the sanctions against the Iraqi people for 10 years,
could you give us your question?
It's a moral and ethical obligation of the United States nation and their governments to make up for the 300,000 Iraqi lost in the South when your president, George Bush, or the American president, George Bush, asked the Iraqis to rise up against Saddam Hussein and try to, take him down, and they will help. Now, finally, you have said, and that takes all your integrity and credibility out, that the Iraqi government is a puppet government. I think you are a puppet, because my Iraqi government is elected by the Iraqi people.
Okay, I think we were able to get a lot of that. I don't think you have a fan there, Anthony.
That's fine.
I
didn't quite hear all of it because of the sound levels, but I'll respond to what I thought were the two points. The first point is something, first of all, that I brought up earlier, that I think the United States has an enormous obligation to the Iraqi people. And as I said, not just for the harm and destruction caused by this occupation, but before that, the sanctions, which I mentioned, before that, the Iran-Iraq war, which I mentioned, before that, all of the years of supporting the brutal dictatorship of Saddam Hussein, which I mentioned, and then also, very importantly, as your caller pointed out, the support of the rise of Saddam Hussein and the Ba'ath Party, going back in particular to a very important moment when in 1963 the CIA supplied the party with lists of activists, trade unionists, members of the Iraqi Communist Party who were slaughtered. And of course we hear now all of this discussion about why isn't there a secular left, or why isn't there a democratic left in Iraq, and the United States actually helped systematically destroy that left. That opposition helped undermine Iraqi democracy, because as they have done in Iraq and as they have done elsewhere in the region, they've opposed democratic movements that might have put the resources of the region in the control of ordinary people rather than in the hands of dictators who are aligned with the United States, rather than putting power in the hands of Western oil corporations. And that's what they're seeking to reestablish right now, is control of Western oil corporations and control of people whose interests are not in serving the Iraqi public, but are in serving the needs of their foreign master. And that's the real role that the current Iraqi government plays. It's why opinion poll after opinion poll shows that people view the Iraqi security forces not as independent, but as collaborating with an unwanted foreign occupation. And it's why the people have a different position than the government. The people want the occupiers to leave. The government wants them to stay. That's a completely untenable situation. And as long as that situation continues, you're going to have more and more distortion and destabilization of Iraqi society and more violence. It's only going to compound all of the tragedies that the caller mentioned earlier.
Well, thank you very much, Anthony. We have a caller, Matt from Kansas. Matt, can you give us a brief question for our guest, Anthony Arnold?
Yes, Anthony Arnold. My question is, sir, what do you think about the debate arising between the army, between the Dragon Skin? Do you think it could save our troops' lives? What's your opinion on that?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear the full question. Could you repeat just the middle part, the debate over what exactly?
The armor in Iraq, the dragon.
Oh, armor, yes, okay.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, I didn't quite get that either. Thank
okay,
you
no,
very
I understand
much.
The question. And I'll, well, first of all, you know, George Bush says support the troops. We have to support the troops. That's the mantra we hear over and over again, support the troops. Well, what does that mean? Does it mean provide the troops with the resources they need, with the mental health resources, with body armor that would protect them in cases where they're being ambushed and fired upon? And soldiers have pointed out repeatedly that they're being sent into battle without adequate protective gear. And in many cases are suffering severe injuries, completely life-debilitating injuries, and, of course, also death as a result of lack of adequate protection because the military isn't providing the kind of body armor and other protection that they need. And we see now more than 3,400 U.S. soldiers dead, more than 26,000 wounded, most of those so severely that they can't return to battle. And the toll is, by the way, increasing at a much higher rate since Bush sent more troops into Iraq early in 2007 as part of this so-called surge. So the rate of death for U.S. soldiers is increasing. So really we see that the talk about protecting the troops, supporting the troops, is just rhetoric. What they really mean is support the president, support the government, don't ask questions, and we don't really give a damn about the troops who are being sacrificed for the interests of the people who are prosecuting this war. And when they come home, aren't getting any kind of psychiatric treatment. They're coming home to hospitals like Walter Reed that are abysmal, in which they're ridiculed and abused when they try to get any kind of psychiatric treatment. You've seen a huge spike in suicides. But really, the question of armor, I think, is just one part of a much bigger story of the contradiction between what soldiers were told and what is really happening. They were told, quick, easy victory, you'll be greeted as liberators. Instead, they're now there on their second, third, in some cases, fourth tour of duty. People are being kept in Iraq, even if they fulfilled their military contract as a reservist through the stop-loss program, through the individual ready reserve. People's tour of duty has been extended. A lot of people fighting are now reservists.
If I can interject, you did talk about this in your book, and what you and your basic concern has been that because of this this illusion that our soldiers went into Iraq for, there's been a breakdown of understanding, communication. We are no longer functioning as a whole group because the confusion that's going on. We were told one thing and we're seeing another. And on the ground, our soldiers are very, are not happy with this.
No, not at all.
We hear it all the time. We hear it all the time here on our show.
Yeah, they're saying they want to come home. And you have, very importantly, you have soldiers beginning to organize and to speak out in a military culture, which really makes it quite difficult for people to speak out, makes it very difficult for people to assert their individuality, to resist the authority, to challenge the authority of their military superiors. And you have people declaring conscientious objection, people like Aaron Matata, people like Camilo Mejia, and more importantly, you have people coming together in organizations, groups, particularly like Iraq Veterans Against War, which I think is playing a leading role in educating people in this country about what's really happening in Iraq and in pushing for withdrawal.
We've had several members of Iraq Vets Against the War on our program, and they are a valiant and very vocal group. Even another caller, Abu Falestin, who is from Chicago. Abu Falestin, if you'll come to the microphone and please give us a brief question for our guest, Anthony Arnoff. Hello?
Hello. Yeah, thank you, and I congratulate you for this beautiful radio program. Well, my question to your guest is, I did not see his book, and I salute him for at least trying to correct a wrongful situation that we all Americans are suffering from. Don't we need to address the reasons behind why we are in Iraq? Sometimes I'm wondering about 9/11, and that reminds me of the question, was the chicken created before the egg, or the egg was created before the chicken? So I don't know. 9/11, was it the reason for invading Iraq, or Iraq was the reason for 9/11 to invade Iraq? Because the lies from this administration was exposed to the public about the reasons they gave us prior to invading Iraq. That's the mass destruction weapon and the connection with 9/11 that proven to be a lie. So what is the reason? And another question to your guest. What is, how you see Israel in the picture? Do you see Israel behind this whole ordeal? Because they are certainly behind and manipulating the American foreign policy at large. Thank you.
To the first question, why the invasion? I spoke earlier to it. I'll just summarize my view, which is that the United States intervened not for democracy, not for human rights, not because Iraq posed any kind of threat, not because of weapons of mass destruction. In other words, not for any of the stated reasons we were given for the war. They intervened to dominate and control the oil and energy resources of Iraq and of the Middle East. They intervened to set up a military base in Iraq from which to project power in the region, particularly against Iran and also Syria. They intervened to limit the emergence of other countries with access to Middle Eastern energy resources, independent of U.S. control, particularly rivals to the U.S. status as the world's sole superpower, countries like China, India, countries in the European Union that are far more reliant on those energy resources. And they intervened to have a demonstration effect, to show that they're still the boss, that they call the shots. And they used 9/11 as a pretext. I don't think that there's any evidence whatsoever that they engineered or planned 9/11, but certainly once it took place, they used it as a pretext for a very aggressive foreign policy of expanding U.S. empire in Central Asia, in Western Asia, in the Middle East, and we've seen the horrible price that's been paid for that. In terms of the question of Israel, I think it's very important for us to say that we can't talk about Iraq in isolation, and we can't talk about how this occupation is wrong and ignore another occupation which has been going on for far longer in the region. So I think it's very important for people in the anti-war movement to be speaking out against the Israeli occupation. On June 10th in Washington, D.C., there's a demonstration opposed to the occupation, the expansion of Israeli occupation, which goes on every day. It's the 40th anniversary of the 1967 June War, which vastly expanded the amount of territory under Israeli control and the dispossession of more Palestinian refugees. So it's an important time to make those links. But I don't think that the tail wags the dog. In other words, Israel is a client state of the United States. It is not the case that the United States is a client of Israel. Israel is the watchdog of U.S. interests in the Middle East. The U.S. calls the shots. And while Israel certainly plays a role in terms of cheerleading for the war in Iraq and supporting the kind of propaganda effort to sell that war, and while it's trying to do a very similar thing right now with regard to Iran, the policy interests are not driven by Israel. They're not driven by groups in the United States that support Israeli interests or claim to support Israeli interests. It's driven by the fundamental institutional needs of American empire, which is why the United States relies on Israel in the Middle East, but it's why it also for many years supported Saddam Hussein. It's why it's aligned with Arab dictatorships. It's why it funds billions of dollars.
I have to tell you, though, Anthony, I find it really difficult to believe that we're holding a string over Israel. And, you know, we have heard so many retorts and retaliation about the United States. You know, here in the United States, we call them allies. And I don't think they necessarily feel the same way about the Americans, but I could be wrong. One of the things that I would like to for you to expound upon is many, I'm being bombarded by the question, I guess it's important, what role is Israel playing in Iraq, and is the Mossad, there are many reports of the Mossad doing a lot of the training in the Iraqi territory, the occupied territories there. What do you think about that?
Well, listen, before the U.S. went into Iraq, they had training sessions with Israeli military and intelligence forces, specifically planning for the possibility of engaging in urban warfare, the kinds of street-to-street combat that we see. They've imported tanks, specially equipped Israeli tanks, that are used in the occupied territories into Iraq to be used in cities like Fallujah, where we've seen tremendous abuses of Iraqi civil rights taking place along a pattern very similar to the one that the United States and Israel together have engineered in the West Bank and Gaza. So absolutely, there's cooperation, there's collaboration. But even, I think it's important to say this, even in the absence of Israeli support for U.S. actions in Iraq or Israeli in training, the United States on its own was absolutely capable of and interested in carrying out this particular operation, invasion, occupation, and is persisting in it for its own interests, not for the interests of another country.
Well, I we could go on like this forever. This has just been absolutely wonderful. We apologize for the late start. Somehow we just couldn't connect, but we want to thank you very much, Anthony, for being with us tonight. We really would like for you to come back because there's just so much more. You're such a wealth of information on this. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you, our guest, Anthony Arnoff. The book, Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal, very interesting, very informative. If you don't know anything about what's happening there, you will after reading this book. Tomorrow night we have a special People Speak radio show. Our guest is Robert Bryan, the attorney for Mutmiam Abu Jamal. Abu Jamal is an award-winning Pennsylvania journalist who exposed police violence against minority communities and has been on death row since 1982. We hope you'll be with us tomorrow evening. Anthony, thank you so much again. And
thanks
good luck
for having
with your
me on
book
the show.
And good luck with all of your work.
Good luck with
and,
your program. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And you heard it, grassroots. That's where it's at. Make a difference. Thank you. And good night, everybody.
One bright sunny morning, in the shadow of the table, by the relief of the fence, I saw my people. And they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering how this land was made for you and me. This land is yours. This land is mine, land from California to the New York Island, redwood forest to the Gulf Stream water. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.